The Church of God the Eternal presents What is the Natural Body? This is the number 6 tape in this series, and it will be given by Mr. Raymond Cole.
You will recall we laid down a basic fabric of what God calls the body of sin. You remember we read in the early part of Romans that in Romans 6 and verse 6 it is called the body of sin. The body is made up of members. So within that body then are specific areas of problems. Our body of sin, such as the hands, the eyes, the mind, the feet, the brain, and so on. We have already covered in the earlier part of this, the natural ear. It hears what it wants to hear. What it does not want to hear, it refuses to accept. The natural eyes see exactly what they want to see and nothing more, and they refuse anything else. Then the natural feet are going to take us where we want to go and to do the things that we want to. We have natural impulses that guide and lead us. Our natural hands, we have identified also the action, the behavior of those hands. And then we got into this matter of the natural heart. Didn't quite complete it, so I want to cover just a little more on the matter of the natural heart. And then from that, we're going to get into the one that's going to affect all of us, our taste buds. We have natural tastes. And let's see if the Bible doesn't say a little about those tastes. Or let's see if we control them. Are we in control of the faculties of our minds, our hearts, our taste buds, or do they rule us? But first, let's complete the one on the natural heart. We started off by showing that the natural heart must be circumcised, a term in spiritual parlance, meaning that it no longer is allowed to exercise its own options, to do the things that it wants to. It has to come under control. So spiritual circumcision means the circumcision then of thought patterns, the circumcision of control in our lives. We notice then also that the natural heart is impure and untrustworthy. We read a great number of texts, or a considerable number of texts in that regard. And then we saw that the natural heart has to be tried. It's got to be subjected to the acid test or to the fiery trial. And then we saw also that the natural heart is arrogant and unteachable. It just isn't going to be taught because it knows what it's going to do, and it'll tell you so in no uncertain terms. Then we saw also that the natural heart is compromising and it is deceptive. But we also saw that the natural heart is not only partial, it is doubtful and unsure. We saw also that it is by nature evil in its orientation. And we saw then that it is subject to adverse influence and discouragement. But is there anything else that might be a problem to the human heart, the natural heart? In Deuteronomy 11 and verse 16, we notice another trait or characteristic. Deuteronomy 11 and noting verse 16. Take heed to yourselves that your heart be not deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Now, what God is showing here very clearly is that as men evaluate, that is, as they confront their responsibility, even though in this case there had been a direct gift, the gift of the truth of God, miraculously, powerfully given. Could anybody deny the fact that it was the intervention of God when he thundered out from heaven and all Israel stood and quaked in his presence? They knew. And then God said to human beings, take heed to yourselves. That is, become conscious of the deceptive nature of the heart, the fact that it is easily influenced. Because we're talking about now a member of the body that is emotionally responsive. It is amazing how many people will change their orientation on the basis of an underdog feeling. If we dislike a situation, or if we have an unusual empathy for somebody, if we feel in some way emotionally about a situation, we will allow ourselves to make a determination with respect to God's truth on that basis. It has been done not just a few hundred times, thousands and even millions of times, because we are emotionally motivated. God's truth stands as an absolute. It has nothing to do with the emotions of human beings. The emotions of human beings have nothing more to do with it than the determination of whether we do or don't, and how we may adversely or, in a sense, positively influence somebody else. It never changes the absolute of God's truth. Never. And so there are millions, yea, I should say, probably every mortal that's ever walked, who makes most of his decisions emotionally. Take heed to yourselves, God said, that your heart be not deceived, that you do not become involved because of the emotional configuration of the conditions or the circumstances. And then you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. There is another factor in the human makeup of that natural heart. It is conniving and self-oriented. It is conniving and self-oriented even to the point that it is this very factor which precipitates self-righteousness. There are those who will feel their sense of exaltation. They feel the absoluteness of their rightness, and they're convinced of it. Nothing said to the contrary will influence them one way or the other. The human heart is conniving. It will do its level best to justify any emotional response which may occur. You know, it reminds me at this particular point, although I haven't been following it, except there is an emotional trait and characteristic that has manifested itself in the recent interrogation of the Contra affair. We have a new idol, a new hero within this country. Do you know why? I saw it in the paper this morning. A man that originally lied and said he did so deliberately, who finally came out and admitted that he lied, and then proceeded from that particular point to put the B on Congress. I have never in my life, and it isn't all that long, seen a body of 400 and some people run so hard. At this particular point, Oliver North could make mincemeat out of them. And he may just do it, too. Who knows? But he's made them look utterly ridiculous. Now, what happened? Here was a man that apparently didn't. He lied, yes, he admitted it. Then came out and just told them. Frankly, he did so, but for reason. And now he becomes a national hero. on the basis of emotion. Oh, sure, there are other factors involved in it too. But because of the honesty and integrity that has proceeded from that, he has shown the absolute knavery and the ridiculous concepts of his interrogators. So I don't know what's going to come out of it, but I've never seen the twist almost overnight that has occurred like that before, ever. So I don't know, you know, right now I noticed that there's a hue and cry for Ollie to become president. So who knows what will happen? All right, the human heart is conniving, and it is self-oriented. It's going to do its level best to protect itself. In Deuteronomy 15 and verse 9, beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart. Now, this is rather objectively stated. He wasn't addressing any particular individual. He just said to them, which was applicable to all Israel, he said, beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart. So he must be implying then, by nature, they are already endowed with a wicked heart. And then to proceed from that is an attempt to rationalize in a form of self-justification. See what is going to happen. Let's read it. Beware that there be not a thought in thy wicked heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and thine eye be evil against thy poor brother. You see, it might not even show up. They might not go out and literally announce it. They might not say, in fact, they wouldn't say, well, you know, I don't really want to give to my poor brother, and I'm not going to live up to that law. They won't be honest. No, but what they'll do is find a rationalization that makes them feel good. That's what they're going to shoot for. So he said that when they see these things and they realize that there are things that they need to do, concepts that they should hang on to, hold dear, they're going to think down in these hearts a wicked thought. They're not going to reveal it. They're not going to say what it is, but they will make it sound awfully good to get out of whatever they don't want to do. So the heart, then, is conniving. That's what God said. Well, it's the one who became Christ. It's conniving and self-oriented. It's going to find a manner of explaining whatever the situation is that justifies that self, rather than saying, no, I don't want my will. What do you want, God? That's what I'm going to do. And that's what I'll live up to. No, it won't do that. And here God knew and understood that, so he even evaluated it in the case of the seventh year and the year of release. Next, I want you to notice Deuteronomy 29. Deuteronomy, the 29th chapter. And let's note verses 18 through 19. Deuteronomy 29, and beginning in verse 18. Lest there should be among you man or woman, or family, or tribe, whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God. Meaning that now there is some kind of a family-oriented thrust. They're not going to do it individually. Now they're going to try to even get to the family, and then from the family on to a tribe even. You know, it reminds me of the statement that I've given to you. It's not a perfect statement. I don't remember exactly how the old adage goes. But man, the independent cuss that he is, cannot stand alone in his conviction. Arrogant, cussed, and indifferent. But there is one thing about it. He wants to make sure somebody else agrees with his philosophy. and he will do his level best. Have you ever seen it within a group? The first thing they're going to do is reach out, and they've got to convince somebody else. They cannot go out, close their mouths, and say, well, I'll stand in my own conviction. No, they're going to pull somebody. It is as satanic as anything can be. But they'll do it. All human beings are built like that. We have to justify it by making sure we pull somebody else. And then people come and ask me, well, now, if Satan knows he's going to go down the drain, why in the world is he out here trying to destroy everybody else? Need you ask? It's the same old principle. Same old principle. They will not give up. And obviously, even in the day of the ultimate test, there are those who will stand adamantly, looking in the very face of Almighty God and say, I will never change. They probably will do it. Because at that particular point, they know the die is cast. It's a fait accompli. And they won't change. They're not even going to give anybody the benefit of the doubt and change their opinion. They'll go down dragging their heels. Why? Self-justification. I was right all the way through it. They will not change. Now notice, lest there should be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations, lest there should be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace. Defiant. Don't ever think that human beings are the pliable, flexible creatures that a lot of people would like us to believe. So they're going to hear the words of this curse, and they're going to stand there and bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination of mine heart to add drunkenness to thirst, and so on. Psalms 58, verses 1 and 2. Psalms 58, verses 1 and 2. Do you indeed speak righteousness, O congregation? Do you judge uprightly, O you sons of men? Yea, in heart you work wickedness. You weigh the violence of your hands in the earth. They speak of righteousness. They put on an image. Yet the calculated intent is deceptive. Hearts that work wickedness and that are constantly weighing violence, evil, nefarious purposes, but always with a camouflage, a screen of acceptability, of honesty, of integrity. The heart is conniving and self-oriented. Another principle is, it's just not subject to truth. Why is it not subject to truth? You have to understand that truth is not merely a physical way. We have within the vast, far-flung sphere of this universe both physical things and spiritual things. Truth, the truth is spiritual. And everything else is physical. So it is not then merely a matter of deciding that I've been going this way, I want to go this way, as a human endeavor. That won't change anything. What is necessary is a change of substance. It's a total change of mind and heart. Because as we are told in Philippians 3 and verse 21, the ultimate is we're going to put down this body, this vile body, when it is changed into a spiritual entity. Truth is spiritual. It is the way of the Spirit. Whereas the way of flesh is what I've been giving to you. It's deceptive. It's bad. It's evil. It's wicked. It's hateful. It's everything. So it isn't merely a change of direction, as I said. It's a change of substance. For if we do not have the Spirit of God abiding within us, can't be seen. Spiritual things are not seen. So we are told by the Apostle Paul and also by Moses in the book of Deuteronomy. Spiritual things cannot be seen, even as Christ said, that one who is begotten of the Spirit is begotten of a substance that comes and goes. You can see the effect of it, but you can't see it. Remember John 3? And so we're talking about no longer a mere direction or a way, but we're talking about now a change. The best way I can say it is a change of substance. When we're laying down the old carnal selfish self, and now we are being recreated in the image of one who is eternal, and that through the power of the Spirit. The flesh is a substance that is antithetical to spirit. It's not subject to it because it isn't spirit. It's flesh. Flesh has its own way. It's going to do its own thing. Within it is some good, and within it is a lot of bad. Even as the Bible said, it's both good and bad. But even though it is both good and bad, if by virtue of character and self-control that one should live an exemplary life within the flesh, that doesn't make him a candidate for the kingdom. It may make it easier for him to finally enter into it when God calls him. The only thing that makes one a candidate for God's kingdom is when he lays down the physical and he takes up the spiritual. It is a change of substance. The flesh has its own way, its own pattern of thoughts. It does its own thing. A lot of it's good, and a lot of it is very bad. And then there is the Spirit, and it has its own way. Deuteronomy 29 and verse 4. Deuteronomy 29. And noting verse 4, it says, "Yet the Eternal hath not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day." See, they were physical beings. Even though God had given to them the truth, endless texts will tell you that God had given to them that truth, that way of life. Yet here, at the very conclusion of Moses' ministry now, the Spirit inspired him to write, "Yet the Lord hath not given you an heart to perceive, eyes to see, ears to hear unto this day." So something has to change. God has to then change eyes, ears, taste, heart, whatever, at a time of conversion, so that we begin to hear, we begin to comprehend, we taste of those things which are acceptable in the sight of God, the heart is rightly oriented, rather than the pursuit of that which occurs naturally. Then one other point. Without due care, the called can very easily return to a deceptive heart. Merely because we have been called of God does not guarantee our success. That is why we are told by Jesus Christ that he that endures unto the end, the same shall be saved. Endure what? The heat of the day? Well, maybe. But more particularly, it's a matter of enduring the doubts that plague us. To remain tall and firm in the faith that God gives. For only the faithful shall inherit everlasting life. That have that conviction, that believe it. That see the intangible, the spiritual. They're not visible to the naked eye. They cannot be seen because man cannot lay his hand upon them. He can only know them through the power of the Spirit. He can see the results because those are manifestations. But without that faith, it would be an impossibility for us to endure unto the end. We couldn't do it. We'll falter, but more particularly, we'll give ear to things that begin to appeal to us. That will be the natural route that we would take. In 2 Peter 2, let's notice it. 2 Peter 2, verses 14 and 15. Here, speaking of a situation that would prevail in the last days, somebody now, having eyes full of adultery and that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls and heart, they have exercised with covetous practices, cursed children. Hearts that have made determinations, exercised with covetous practices. Covetous, desirous of some expectation. Something that we want or they want physically. We covet what is tangible, what we can see. And so hearts then that have been set in tune with covetous purposes. It may not be nothing more than numbers. It may be the achievement of certain prestige or power, or whatever it is that motivates them. They want that recognition. And heart, they have exercised with covetous practices. And God says, cursed children, which have forsaken the right way. Somebody in the last days then forsook the right way. And they did so on the basis of hearts that were put through certain exercises. Exercises, obviously, in which they rationalized and justified what they're doing. And they felt absolutely acceptable. They felt they were just as right as anybody else. Hearts they have exercised with covetous practices. They're not identified. Most people probably wouldn't recognize them in the first place. Then how would you know? Only if you know what God's truth is. And that's the standard or the guide. But God says they're not only cursed children, but they have forsaken the right way and are gone astray following the way of Balaam, the son of Bosar, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. What it is saying is that these who do this are those who want tangible returns. Something that they can put their hands on. They judge you by numbers. By a physical standard that you can describe, measure, weigh, or whatever. You do not covet something you cannot see. You covet what is available, tangible, that can be seen. And so he said then, these loved the wages of unrighteousness. What are wages? Returns for endeavor. So whatever then was going on in the hearts of those who were exercised with covetous practices, they want returns, tangible returns, wages, if you please, they can put their hands on. And so our hearts then, naturally, do not weigh things on basis of the intangible, the ethereal. They weigh it on the basis of what they can see. As so many people have said, you know, they evaluate whether it's of God by numbers. Well, they don't have enough people, so therefore it couldn't be of God. Well, I wonder about Christ then when he was the only one. Since he was only one, he couldn't have been of God then, could he? Because if you have only one, that certainly wouldn't be of God. And a lot of people will evaluate it and say, well, if it were a God, you know, they ought to be going pell-mell. They ought to have this, and they ought to have that, and they ought to have something else. Well, I don't know why in the world Christ was such a miserable failure then. For after 3.5 years as a living Christ, he wound up with 120 people. Then is numbers the standard? Why is it that he said in Matthew that broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many there be which go therein? But narrow is the way that leads unto life eternal, and few there be that find it. Why did he also say, and I won't take time to cover all of that, herein, and I probably couldn't locate it out of a different text or a different version of the Bible, because it's here in Galatians. And people are like this. Here in Galatians it says, oh, no wonder it wasn't correct. That was Ephesians. I want Galatians, then we'll get it. Beginning here in verse 5, it says, for every man shall bear his own burden. Let him that is taught in the word communicate unto him that teaches in all good things. Be not deceived, God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to the flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap if we faint not. As we have therefore opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially unto them who are of the household of faith. You see how large a letter I have written unto you with mine own hand. Now notice verse 12. As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh. Why were they desiring this? Because it was tangible. They wanted to make a fair show in the flesh. I don't care whether it's numbers, accomplishment within the group, or whatever it may be. They wanted something tangible. Have you ever heard anyone, to your knowledge, that ever evaluated simply on the basis of the Spirit? I've never heard it yet. They want a tangible guide. And people still want it today because they want to judge one another. They want to evaluate. And why do they want to evaluate? I guess it's a matter of determining whether he's more or less righteous than somebody else. Why are we concerned? If it's a matter of a spiritual relationship, why don't you just pray for them? Because the spiritual things cannot be seen. They're of the heart. God's heart. For God looks on the heart. But no, they wanted to make a fair show in the flesh. They constrain you to be circumcised. Why did they want this? They just absolutely loathed at turning loose of that very physical requirement. You know why? Because you can count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And you know people still want that? We're not much different than they were back in those days. We still want a tangible guide, a yardstick. And God didn't give us one, because it's not our responsibility. As many as desire to make a fair show in the flesh, they constrain you to be circumcised, only lest they should suffer persecution for the cross of Christ. So what he's doing is showing that deceptive nature with which we were born. Now, if we can force it into a tangible structure, then we can start evaluating one another. But if now we're going to push it into the spiritual realm, we're all going to stand equally before God, and we're going to suffer for our faith and our conviction. And that's what Paul said. All right, the natural heart is a conniving, evil thing. But that's what confession is all about. That's the very essence of repentance. We have to come to recognize what those hearts are like and admit it before God. And then can we achieve some significant purpose? Now, I won't get far, but let me see if I can't get an introductory part anyway into this matter of the natural taste. It's the next one. And I have a lot of notes on this, and I want to cover a significant element of it. As humans, we're reluctant to try good things. Have you ever seen a child, any child that was born, who automatically desired only the best natural good substances? No, but I can tell you plenty of them because I see them before me and I've seen a lot of others. They dislike this and they dislike something else. And God said it was good. The man says, no, it ain't. I don't like it. So he isn't going to have it. Why then did God use that very critical problem of man as the basis for evaluation of our spiritual orientation? If so be that you have tasted that the Lord is gracious. Remember that? It didn't mean you took a bite out of him, did it? No. What does it mean then? Well, let's see if we can first paint a physical picture, and then we're going to see the spiritual relationship as we go along. And I'll try to illustrate some points as we go along. But let's understand the one basic thing. We as human beings are born with perverse taste buds. Because we are born anti-scriptural, anti-spiritual. We just don't like spiritual things. And so the best things for us are the things we dislike. Or otherwise, your parallelism would break down. We have to be cultivated to accept natural things and things that are best for us. But oh, how man loves what man creates. Just let man get his hands on it, you know, and remake it and do this and do that, and oh, how we love it. And the junkier it is, the better we like it. And then we'll turn right around and say, Don't you enter into my eating habits. That's my religion. What is it they say? There are three things that you must never discuss with somebody. His politics, his religion, and his diet. If you want real troubles, just get in any one of those areas. You've got them. And I mean real troubles. Well, some people tread where angels fear to, so let's get after it. First, I want you to turn to Psalms 34. Psalms 34, and I want you to note verse 8, but we're going to read verses 7 through 9. In Psalms 34, verses 7 through 9, the angel of the Lord encampeth round about them that fear him, and delivereth them. O taste and see that the Lord is good. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. O fear the Lord, you his saints, for there is no want to them that fear him. There is no lack, there is no deficiency for those who have tasted and have come to appreciate the abundance of Christ. Well, now, what is Christ? We're going to have to see what Christ is as we go along. But whatever it is, he likens it unto tasting. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Now, as I said, it's highly doubtful that he meant for you to go and literally take a bite out of his flesh. Well, then what is it that you're tasting, you're going to ingest? I want you to next turn to Genesis 1. We're only building a little foundation right now. We aren't even going to begin to evaluate. Genesis, the first chapter, and let's begin in verse 29 and read through verse 31. And God said, behold, I have given you every herb bearing seed, which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed. To you it shall be for meat. That means for food. The Hebrew word here simply means food. It shall be for food. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creepeth upon the earth, wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for food. And it was so. And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was very good. Do you agree? Everything that God made, and he made it for you, and he said, behold, it was very good. Now, if you disagree, maybe you need to start working on some perverse taste buds. And the evening and the morning were the sixth day. All right, next I want you to notice 1 Timothy 4. Here is a New Testament usage. It doesn't mean meat, it's still food. The word here is food in the same way. 1 Timothy 4, and I want to read the first five verses. Now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith. Quite an interesting parallelism here. I'd like for you to notice it. He's talking about now the spiritual truths of God, and they're called food. Now the Spirit speaks expressly that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons. speaking lies in hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron, forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God hath created to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth, those called who know it, who believe and know the truth, for every substance, created substance, creature, it is the word K-T-I-Z-O, ketidzo. Every ketidzo or creation of God is good, and nothing to be refused if it be received with thanksgiving, for it is sanctified by the word of God and prayer. Now, I'm not going to give you all the technical detail there. I have a whole raft of notes here, but in the column or the surrounding the text here, I do not want to give those at this time because they're not relative to the subject. What I want us to understand is that if we receive it with the right understanding, in the knowledge of God and the purpose for which it was created, it is called good, because it was created for us, for our good health, and for vitality and strength. Now, the Greek word meat, I'll give you just this much of it, is the word broma, B-R-O-M-A, meaning food. For that, you might want to, if you want to check me up, fine, go right ahead. See the Greek-English Lexicon by Arndt Gingrich and Bauer, page 147. Now, pardon me, this is the concordance. I'm talking about Brown, Driver, and Briggs. This is the lexicon itself. And there we'll give you a complete breakdown on it. Now I'd like for you to very quickly compare just a few texts in that regard. Let's turn to Matthew 14 and verse 15. Matthew 14 and verse 15. We're not going to get the analysis of this yet because we have to lay down some subject material first. Matthew 14 and verse 15, it says, "And when it was evening, his disciples came to him, saying, This is a desert place, and the time is now past. Send the multitude away, that they may go into the villages and buy themselves victuals." The word victuals is the word broma. The same word. Mark 7 and verse 9. Mark 7 and verse 9. "And he said unto them, Full well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your own tradition. For Moses said, Honor thy father and thy mother, and whoso causes father or mother, curses father or mother, let him die the death." Interestingly, they reject the commandment of God that they may hang on to their own convictions. Now, God gave a commandment that relates to food. Men reject it with all kinds of rationalizations. I haven't gotten there yet. Romans 14. Romans, the 14th chapter, verses 1 through 2, and then 14 through 17. 14, verses 1 through 2. "Him that is weak in the faith receive you, but not to doubtful disputations. For one believeth that he may eat all things, another who is weak eateth herbs." But notice what it says. One eateth all things. In other words, the all things obviously have the limitation of that which God created to be received. Remember? 1 Timothy 4. Whereas another one eats only herbs. But God says it's a weakness. He didn't call that strength at all. "Him that is weak in the faith." receive you, but not to doubtful disputations. That is, arguments about food. Now let's drop down to verses 14 through 17. I know and am persuaded by the Lord Jesus that there is nothing unclean of itself. But to him that esteems anything to be unclean, to him it is unclean. Now what are we talking about? God's designation of what's clean and unclean, or are we talking about what men have determined to be clean and unclean? Only what men have determined. Not what God set up at all. God made those determinations, and he already told us, but men just don't want to agree with God. And they have all the rationale in the world to get around it. You know, it's ceremonial, it's not for us today. It's a matter in which they're raised and so on, has nothing to do with it. If anybody would ever just stop to really take the time to read exactly what the physiognomy is of unclean animals or fish. But they won't take the time. They're not going to be troubled with it. They don't want to be troubled with it. If you ever read it, if you ever studied it, I'll guarantee you it'll turn your stomach. God made them as scavengers. Men turn around and want it. Well, you know, men aren't too much better because they scavenge too. Most of the food that they eat today falls in that category. So they esteem, some esteem anything to be unclean, to him it is unclean. But if thy brother be grieved with thy meat, now walkest thou not charitably? What he is saying is, if there is a weak brother that does not know and understand, have a little compassion. The one that is strong should make the overture, should give up. For the Apostle Paul said in this regard, that I won't drink any wine, nor would I eat meat again for the rest of my time. But not many of us will go that far, will we? But I've heard it too many times. Well, that's his tough luck. You know, if he can't get around that hang up, why, let him hang. But God says we should be charitable and have a kind feeling. But if thy brother be grieved with thy meat or food, now walkest thou not charitably, destroy not him with thy food or meat, for whom Christ died. Let not then your good be evil spoken of. Next, I want us to notice 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 2. 1 Corinthians 3 and noting verse 2. Just three or four more texts here and we'll call it to a conclusion today. 1 Corinthians 3 and verse 2. I have fed you with milk and not with meat or broma. For hitherto you were not able to bear it. Neither yet now are you able. You know, if today the ministry elects to be kind and considerate for the weaknesses of certain ones, we're told that we're condoning sin. What a wretched spirit. There are a lot of things. It would be a whole lot better to let them develop on their own than to stand up and say, you're going to live up to my expectation whether you like it or not. They never do. And there's no faith in it. We do not have dominionship over anyone's faith. Let's learn that. And people that believe God's truth are going to make the necessary changes in their own lives. The only responsibility we have is problems developing within. Not regulating somebody else. For remember, the judgment is coming. And we're all going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. Next, I want us to notice 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 13. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 13. Meats for the belly, that is foods for the belly, and the belly for meats. But God shall destroy both it and them. Now the body is not for fornication, but for the Lord, and the Lord or the body. So God made the human system to ingest food, and he made food to satisfy that human body. but not because we should bow and scrape before the human body, but he made the body for a purpose, to serve him. And yet people have made all these things idols. The only addiction we have is not alcoholic. There are other addictions that are far worse. Far worse. Well, when I say worse, I don't mean in character necessarily. I mean they're stronger. And the rationalization to get around is greater. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 3. And did all eat the same spiritual meat? Well, physical food then relates to the spiritual food. Do you suppose that our food prefigures, characterizes the body of Christ, which is the food of life? Or does it characterize the whim of man? The things that we have done that appeal to the natural inclinations. Which? Hebrews 13 and verse 9. 13 and verse 9. Be not carried about with divers and strange doctrines. For it is a good thing that the heart be established with grace and with foods which have not profited them that have been occupied therein. It is amazing how people will idolize concepts, and people become preoccupied on both sides. And so we have a whole raft of organizations created in which they have idolized the longevity of man. And they want to return because they want to increase our lifespan. God already told us what the lifespan is. But how about the character and the quality of the life, which represents what Christ stands for? Next time, we're going to analyze a lot more of it.
The Church of God the Eternal has just presented What is the Natural Body? This was the number 6 tape in the series, and it was given by Mr. Raymond Cole.